Good evening. Turn to our study in the evening of the life of David. You want to open your Bibles to the book of 2 Samuel. 2 Samuel chapter 19. As we return to our study, and we learn from this historical book. It's a historical narrative. It's walking through the events of the life of David, the life of the kings, first kings here, the nation of Israel, and the different interactions that are taking place there, the different personalities. We get to chapter 19, and we've just followed in 19 what would be a brief civil war of which Absalom, the son of David, rises up in an insurrection. He tries to take the kingdom from his father. He capitalized on an event that took place with his sister Tamar as she was assaulted by her stepbrother Amnon, another one of the sons of David. And he wants to get revenge for her, and yet more than that, he really uses that as a springboard or an opportunity for him to win over the hearts of the people, to destroy one of the brothers who would be in line of the kingdom ahead of him, and to establish himself as a king. And so Absalom carries that out. And we have, of course, that conspiracy working its way over the course of a few years until finally the war breaks out. David flees with his men. And then we saw in chapter 16, 17, 18, in that time frame, the end result. Absalom would die at the hands of Joab, and David would return. And now we're in that point in which he's returning. And by way of reminder of that, also, these things are happening under the sovereign oversight of God and the purposes of God and how they work themselves out through the sins of men, through the consequences of the sins of men. And the consequences specifically tied here are not just Absalom's sin. They're not Joab's sin necessarily, as it backs up to David's sin. And when David despised the Lord in his actions back in chapter 11 and 12. And all of this is kind of flowing out of that as the household of David is showing and proving itself here as a household of blood. And so what God had said by way of prophecy back then in those chapters is following through here over the course of some years and showing themselves to this time. And we come to chapter 19, and verse 8 is where I want us to pick up from where we left off last week. This would have come at the word that Absalom has died. David hears this from the messengers and falls into this grief, this mourning for his son, to the extent to where he ignores the troops who had protected him and those who had stood by him, and he is needed to be rebuked by Joab to stand up and give them honor, and he does that. And so it is a difficult time. It's an interesting time. But we're now in the post-Civil War conditions now. So we pick up in verse 8 in the middle of that. It says, "Now Israel had fled every man to his own home. And all the people were arguing throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, 'The king delivered us from the hand of our enemies and saved us from the hand of the Philistines. And now he has fled out of the land from Absalom. But Absalom, whom we anointed over us, is dead in battle. Now therefore, why do you say nothing about bringing the king back?'" So there's the words. There is the confusion. There's an unsettled character going on amongst the tribes of Israel, amongst the nation at this point, of which David is the king. And David is now to return back to the land and naturally would think establish again, once again, his kingdom and his rule. But in these chapters that I want to look at, chapter 19 and chapter 20 tonight, I want us to see a lot of what is really a study of the life of a king. Even the best of situations, spiritually speaking, even a king who is a man after God's own heart, a king who's trying to strive to do what is right in the eyes of God, and around him and surrounding him is all of this swirling politics and intrigue and personal agendas and opportunists and those which David would have to manage in his own rule to protect the kingdom, yet at the same time not allow these individuals to get the upper hand or to carry on their wicked ways, their evil ways. It really is a study in what happens in Washington, D.C. every day, it seems like. We have an innate desire as people to be ruled, to see a ruler take charge of this mess. We just had a debate. I didn't watch a single second of the debate, and words are, it was kind of a messy, crazy debate. We're in the middle of this election and moving towards the vote here in another month. And we have this desire, and it's a good desire to have and want a ruler who will rule in righteousness, without reproach in his personal life, use wisdom, use that wisdom in a timely manner in his actions and decisions. We'd want a ruler to be truthful and gracious in his words and communications. But we would love that, wouldn't we? A ruler who'd be patient, reasonable when accused, attacked, vilified, which seems like it's every day. And one that's respectable and dignified in debate and under the microscope of public opinion and media inquiry and whatever goes on Twitter or whatever social media. And we want that. That's the desire there. And we kind of are not satisfied when we see something else carrying on amongst our rulers. In that, I seem to be asking for a perfect president or perfect ruler in many ways. In America, its moral and spiritual condition, I've heard this said before, it deserves what it gets. It deserves what it gets. And we are struggling through this, and yet we still are the land of the free. And we need to defend that, and we need to continue to vote in light of that, even though the options may not be the best. But what I really want, and I'm thinking about this desire for this ruler, is really something that is all of us, we should have this, a desire to have a king like Jesus. We want the righteous one to rule. We want to sit under the true sovereign one who is all wise, all good, always truthful, always doing what is the best, always has what's best in mind, always is going to operate in a way that brings glory and honor to God on high rather than dragging out all of the sin and all of the wickedness and honor that. We want the Lord Jesus Christ, and that's what we long for. But here we are, about a little less than 3,000 years ago in the land of Israel, and here's probably the second best option, David. And he didn't do everything well, and yet he is a man that God has appointed and anointed, and the nation recognizes that. Here's the one whom we have as the king. Here is the one who defeated our enemies. Here's the one who saved us from the hand of the Philistines. And then we went and anointed his son, who didn't do any of that. And they're in a mess. And they recognize that. And they're in confusion. It's unsettled, to say the least. The time frame in which we could put this, I think most scholars would recognize it somewhere around 970 BC, 969 BC. So you're looking at about 30 years into David's rule that started in Hebron at the death of Saul. And he ruled in the land or the tribal allotments of Judah for about 7 years, waiting out another civil war. And then he finally moved and took over all charge and consolidated the whole nation and ruled then in Jerusalem. And he's been in Jerusalem until the time of Absalom's rebellion and insurrection. And the time frame of him coming back at this point, we would put it somewhere about 30 years into that rule. He's older in his life, probably in his 50s, somewhere in that range. His sons, Absalom's probably in his 30s, and Amnon and the others. And so you kind of get a little better perspective of that, just the time frame. So we're coming in the last quarter of his rule, of his 40-year rule. So let's take a look at, I just want to look at these verses. And we're not really necessarily looking at David specifically here, but these two chapters, from the historical perspective, kind of paint this portrait of all the king's men, the administration, or those who want to be in power, or those who have some influence, or those who are bickering, or those who are wrestling for a place of position. There are some culprits here, and there are some good guys here. And so we want to see a few of them, and that's what the writer, 2 Samuel, brings to our attention here. In the middle of a very unsettled time, David is returning back to Jerusalem and trying to bring things back into a certain measure of peace and tranquility for the nation, which it has seems to not have a lot of time here. Even under David's rule, it just seems like there's always something going on. There's always some type of battle happening, either with his enemies, which he seems to have taken care of, but now the enemies are showing up in his own household, and it just doesn't stop. And he still has to fight this out, and he still has to trust God and to fulfill his duties as king. So what I want to do is just break down a few things for you. I want to start, keep your hand here in, or your finger here in 2 Samuel. Turn over with me to the book of Proverbs. Book right after the book of Psalms, in the middle of your Bible somewhere, in the book of Proverbs. And what you'll find in the book of Proverbs is a number of connected sections in this book that I call the Proverbs for a King. Solomon is the king. He's writing these Proverbs, these 31 chapters. Most of the chapters are Solomon's hand, or at least that which was collected by the men around him, the scribes around him, to bring the Proverbs of Solomon into one work, one book. And a number of them are for a king. He wrote for his son, for the king to be. But that was life wisdom throughout. But there's sections in here that says a king needs to know these things, needs to operate in this way. And so let me point those out to you, because I think these are important. As Solomon has learned as a king, he's learned them from his father, and by what we see here, it'd be very good that David or any ruler would know this. Or if we're thinking of politicians and politics and people we would vote for, this is the type of wisdom they're going to need, of special character. So in chapter 23, let's turn there first, of the book of Proverbs, chapter 23, verses 1 through 5. Verses 1 through 5. And we're going to read, we'll get back to 2 Samuel. I'm going to start seeing a number of names and people. Like I said, good and bad, those who are with him, and those who are, well, kind of with him, but for their own purposes. Familiar names we've already come to know, Joab being one, and others, Abishai. And then we get to know a few others. And there's names, Ziba, Mephibosheth. We've seen these people. They keep coming out of the woodwork, keep coming into the historical narrative here. What are they doing? What's going on here? And so here's the king managing these affairs. How does he do it? What kind of wisdom does he need? Well, chapter 23, did I say 25? 23, verse 1 through 5. When you sit down to eat with a ruler, observe carefully what is before you. Put a knife to your throat if you are given to appetite or gluttonous. Do not desire his delicacies, for they are deceptive food. Do not toil to acquire wealth. Be discerning enough to desist. When your eyes light on it, it is gone, for suddenly it sprouts wings, flying like an eagle toward heaven. So here's some words of caution. You sit down with a ruler, notice and take careful note that when you sit there, this is not just any dinner. This is not just any place and any family. You're welcome in here and you get to eat the meal, you get to have dessert, you get something to drink, and you get some company of conversation. This is the king. This is the ruler. There's always something that is going to be under the table, in a sense, or part of the narrative here of the discussion, or the reason why you're here, or why the king wants you there. And that's politics. Politics doesn't seem to just leave at the front door when you enter into the king's house. It is right there. And so the caution here is observe carefully what's before you. Don't just sit down and be a glutton and take it all in without caution. So there's something of that. Watch out when money is involved. Watch out when power is here, served at the table, or land or wealth or anything that's mixed in with the political relationships is the caution that the Proverbs give us. Chapter 16, and that's important to know that because we'll see, especially with Ziba. He has certain things in mind. He wants more money, more wealth, more power, and he's going to use David to get it. Chapter 16, Proverbs, verse 10 through verse 19. Here's an oracle. It's on the lips of a king. His mouth does not sin in judgment. A just balance and scales are the Lord's. All the weights in the bag are his work. It's an abomination to kings to do evil. For the throne is established by righteousness. Righteous lips are the delight of a king. And he loves him who speaks what is right. The king's wrath is a messenger of death, and a wise man will appease it. In the light of a king's face there is life, and his favor is like the clouds that bring the spring rain. How much better to get wisdom than gold. To get understanding is to be chosen rather than silver. The highway of the upright turns aside from evil. Whoever guards his way preserves his life. Pride goes before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall. It's better to be in a lowly spirit with the poor than to divide the spoil with the proud. So there's a number of proverbs stated here tied to the king and tied to life and death, and how a kingdom should be established in righteousness, in truth. It's what a good king would desire. In other words, don't mess with the king. He has the power of life or death. He desires you to tell the truth. He desires you to establish righteousness because he desires to establish righteousness. At least that is the design. Verse 27, same chapter. Verse 27 to verse 32, a worthless man plots evil. His speech is like a scorching fire. There's some plotters going on in 2 Samuel around David. Plotting evil. A dishonest man spreads strife, and a whisperer separates close friends. A man of violence entices his neighbor and leads him in a way that is not good. Whoever winks his eyes plans dishonest things. He who purses his lips brings evil to pass. Gray hair is a crown of glory. It is gained in a righteous life. Whoever is slow to anger is better than the mighty. He who rules his spirit than he who takes a city. There's a few words, good words in there, especially the gray hair part. I like that. But notice these. Notice these people that Solomon lays down here. The worthless man. See that? Verse 27. The worthless man. What does he do? Plots evil. His speech is like a scorching fire. Don't trust what he says. What he's going to say is going to cause a fire. James chapter 3. James 3 in the tongue of fire. And here it is. It's going to spread rumors. It's going to spread lies. It's going to spread deceit. It's going to create what is going to be a destructive force. That's the worthless man. Would do well for David to know who those worthless men are. Then he has the dishonest man in verse 28. Spread strife. So his lack of truth, his lack of honesty. He's using lies and deception to create an effect that is of strife, a whisperer. There's the gossip, separates close friends. Be careful what they say, David. Be careful what they say, King. What they say may have the end result that would create division in your kingdom. The violent man, verse 29. A man of violence, he entices his neighbor, leads him in a way that is not good. He wants to destroy. The man of violence. There are some men of violence around David. One of them is by the name of Joab. Joab has blood on his hands multiple times. Watch out for that man. And then he says, whoever winks his eyes plans dishonest things. He who purses his lips brings evil to pass. So here is this halo data. Here's this person who is maybe not saying it out front, but by his behavior, the winking of the eye, the pursing of the lips, he's communicating something. He has other intentions that may not be spoken outright. So he's the type of people here that the king, Solomon, is wanting his son to be careful, to be watchful of this, to learn from this. Right? Turn to 25 now, chapter 25, verse 1 to 7. And all of these can be tied directly to the help and the assistance that a king would need or what's happening within his court. 25, verse 1 to 7. These also are Proverbs of Solomon, which the men of Hezekiah, king of Judah, copied. It is the glory of God to conceal things, but the glory of kings is to search things out. As the heavens for height and the earth for depth, so the heart of kings is unsearchable. Take away the dross from the silver, and the smith has material for a vessel. Take away the wicked from the presence of the king, and his throne will be established in righteousness. That, by the way, that would be the goal of David right now. This is what you need to do, David. Verse 6, do not put yourself forward in the king's presence or stand in the place of the great, for it is better be told, come up here, than to be put lower in the presence of a noble. What your eyes have seen, do not hastily bring into court, for what will you do in the end when your neighbor puts you to shame? So there's some wisdom about approaching the king and how the king is to operate and to be prudent to remove the wicked from his presence. Now the chapter 28, there's a few more proverbs that we can add to this list. Verse 2, when a land transgresses, it has many rulers. But with a man of understanding and knowledge, its stability will long continue. Again, king, you want to be a man of understanding and knowledge because that results in the land having steadfast peace and continuance. Verse 4 and 5, those who forsake the law praise the wicked, but those who keep the law strive against them. Evil men do not understand justice, but those who seek the Lord understand it completely. Again, more good words to be heard. Verse 7, the one who keeps the law is a son with understanding, but a companion of gluttons shames his father. Whoever multiplies his wealth by interest and profit gathers it for him who is generous to the poor. More words that would be helpful. Verse 12, when the righteous triumph, there is great glory, but when the wicked rise, people hide themselves. The righteous triumph, where? In a kingdom. You want the righteous to triumph. You want the righteous to be lifted up. You want the law to protect the righteous. And you want the law to bring judgment and punishment to the wicked. But if you reverse that and the wicked rise up, the people are now hiding themselves behind boarded doors and shut down shops in the cities. Verse 14, blessed is the one who fears the Lord always, but whoever hardens his heart will fall into calamity. Verse 16, a ruler who lacks understanding is a cruel oppressor, but he who hates unjust gain will prolong his days. So there's actions that the king can take here that will result in the long continuance and the prolonging of the days of his kingdom and for his people. Verse 18, whoever walks in integrity will be delivered, but he who is crooked in his ways will suddenly fall. In verse 26, whoever trusts in his own mind is a fool, but he who walks in wisdom will be delivered. So these are words, again, to help understand and help be wise and discerning. One more, chapter 30 of Proverbs, 30, verse 29, 30 and 31. Three things are stately in their tread. Four are stately in their stride. The lion, which is mightiest among beasts, and does not turn back before any. The strutting rooster, the he-goat, and a king whose army is with him. And here we have the words of the king and his army. The king needs his army. The king needs his army to be with him on his side, hearing him, and he leading them. This is, of course, the context that we find David. David's life, David's rule. He is a king, and yet he's a commander of his own armies, and he has men who are generals underneath him who must be loyal to him. But this is where the challenge comes, and this is where we face the issues now as we come to 2 Samuel. So turn back there. King's Proverbs. And what's swirling around David in his return to Jerusalem, this politics, requests for favor, agendas that everybody else seems to have for himself, and maybe what they say, this is best for you, king, if you do these things. All of that you'd expect to be happening normally, but now at this time to establish and bring peace back to the nation, others are going to come in and begin to be opportunistic on this. And he has to be careful. So let's look at the king's culprits. Look at these names. Shimei, familiar with him? Joab, Sheba, Abishai, Amasa, Ziba, and Mephibosheth. There's also Joab. We'll save him for the end. He's the biggest of them all. There's some culprits in this group. The leadership of the elders of Israel are even in this group. And the tribe of Judah is in this group. The every man that went home, Israel there in verse 8, chapter 19, Israel had fled every man to his own home, and all the people were arguing throughout all the tribes of Israel. So now you have the elders and the leaders, the soldiers, whoever else, they're now in an argument. There's an unsettled debate going on. What do we do now? We anointed Absalom to be king. He's dead. Now we need to bring David back. What's going to happen? What's going to happen to all of us? Is David going to take vengeance on us? Who knows what their thoughts are? But there is debates going on. We have debates with the two presidential candidates. In David's time, the debates were going on amongst their elders, amongst the tribes, about what to do and what's happening over his return. Verse 11, he goes after his tribe, Judah. And King David sent this message to Zadok and Abiathar the priests. Say to the elders of Judah, who's one of the 12 tribes, this is David's tribe. This would be the tribes of the tribes. This would be the one tribe that anointed David first some 30 years previous in Hebron. So he ruled Judah for 7 years before the civil war ended. And then he took over all the other tribes when he moved into Jerusalem. So this is the loyal tribe, supposedly. And here's the question. Say to the elders of Judah, why should you be the last to bring the king back to his house when the word of all Israel has come to the king? You are my brothers. You are my bone and my flesh. Why then should you be the last to bring back the king? And say to Amasa, are you not my bone and my flesh? God do so to me and more also if you are not commander of my army from now on in place of Joab. And he swayed the heart of all the men of Judah as one man so that they sent word to the king, return both you and all your servants So the king came back to the Jordan, and Judah came to Gilgal to meet the king and to bring the king over to the Jordan. So David is over in the east, and he's ready to return, but he's not just coming back. He wants an escort, and that escort is to be his own tribe. And he's saying, why shouldn't you be the ones to lead me back? Why should you be last to give acknowledgement to this? You should lead the way. And he persuaded them to do this. And so here is this, what may seem like Judah's lack of initiative at this point. And later this is going to contribute a little bit of tribal jealousy and favoritism. Does he favor Judah over the rest of us? Every man to his own house. Every man to his own tribe. David is not for us. And so there's going to be a little bit of that going on. Then we see this in verse 16. And I want you to note, by the way, Amasa. Amasa was the, he would be a nephew of David. He would be a cousin to Joab and Abishai. So they're relatives. And all this stuff, these names are showing up. They're within his family. But Amasa was the one who was given the commands of all the armies of Israel by Absalom, while Joab went with David and Abishai as they fled. So this is an interesting little decision he makes. Amasa, you're now going to be my general, not Joab. What does that communicate to Joab? Probably not some good warm fuzzies, to say the least. Verse 16. Here's another name, Shimei. And Shimei, the son of Gerah, the Benjamite. Okay, the Benjamites, that's the tribe of Saul. Saul came from the Benjamite tribe, and they would probably have a little bit of thoughts about, you know, the throne was once ours, was in our family. And here's this other one who rises up, another one of the tribe. It says that the Benjamite from Bahurim, he hurried to come down with the men of Judah to meet King David. And with him were 1,000 men from Benjamin, and Ziba, the servant of the house of Saul, with his 15 sons and his 20 servants, rushed down to the Jordan before the king. So you have Shimei and you have Ziba. These two showed up earlier. When David left Jerusalem, fleeing from Absalom, Ziba would be Mephibosheth's servant. We'll get to him in a moment. Shimei is up on the hillside pelting David with rocks, saying, go out, you bloodshed, you killer. All the blood of the house of Saul, Shimei's family, be on David's head. And so here's Shimei mocking and taunting David when he left. Now he's coming back. Shimei goes out to meet him. It says here, as they rushed down to the Jordan before the king, and they crossed the ford to bring over the king's household and to do his pleasure. And Shimei, the son of Gerah, fell down before the king as he was about to cross the Jordan and said to the king, let not my lord hold me guilty or remember how your servant did wrong on the day my lord the king left Jerusalem. Do not let the king take it to heart, for your servant knows that I have sinned. Therefore, behold, I have come this day, the first of all the house of Joseph, to come down to meet my lord the king. The first of the house of Joseph. The house of Joseph. So here is Shimei. He arrives, and how does David receive him? This is the guy who is pelting me with rocks. This is the guy who is mocking me and telling me to get out of town. Let Absalom take over. You're a worthless king, or whatever it is you want to read into that. Here he is now, down on his face, apologizing, pleading for forgiveness. I did wrong. I sinned. How should David respond to that? Should he grant that and say, all right, everything's good, no big deal? This is Shimei. Everybody knows this guy, especially the sons of Zariah, who would be Joab and Abishai. Next verse, verse 21. Abishai, the son of Zariah, answered, shall not Shimei be put to death for this because he cursed the Lord's anointed? Do you remember the Proverbs there, men of violence? I mean, here is Abishai. Of course, he's kind of like a bodyguard. He's kind of like the Secret Service here in a way. I'm here to protect you. I'm going to do everything that's going to take to bring back the honor of your name, David, and that may mean slaying this dude because he was cursing you, the Lord's anointed. I should do that, right? Well, there's a lust for retaliation. Here is this man who is one of those nephews of David. Verse 22, but David said, what have I to do with you, you sons of Zariah, that you should this day be as an adversary to me? Shall anyone be put to death in Israel this day? For do I not know that I am this day king over Israel? And the king said to Shimei, you shall not die. And the king gave him his oath. So he made the decision there. So kind of weighing out, what do I do? Would it be wise to slay this guy so you would stop his mouth? Let Abishai get away with that. Abishai, the son of Zariah, who seems to be a little bit of a loose cannon, just as Joab is. Though they were faithful, they were loyal. And David's weighing this out, and he chooses instead to pardon and let the man live. So this is the type of culprits that are showing up, and this is the type of stuff he's having to deal with. Moving on, next verse, verse 24. And Mephibosheth, the son of Saul, came down to meet the king. Now Ziba is already there. Mephibosheth shows up. Ziba is, of course, if you remember, he's the servant of the house of Saul. That would probably mean that he had management oversight of all the servants and the slaves and the property and the possessions of the house of Saul, the king. Now all the sons of Saul, everybody of that house is pretty much dead, except Mephibosheth, who's the crippled youngest son here. And what can he do? And David had already granted Mephibosheth all the possessions of the house of Saul to be restored to him, and Ziba to rule it and manage it and make sure that Mephibosheth gets his proper share out of that. Well, as David was fleeing, Mephibosheth, or Ziba, shows up and gives honor to David and says, well, Mephibosheth, he's back in Jerusalem. He's going to join the other side. He's against you. Is that true? Is that a rumor? What's he trying to say? And now Ziba shows up at this time to welcome David back. I'm on your side. Always been loyal. Always been truthful. But then Mephibosheth gets to answer. You hear the one man until you hear the other man. You think this is right. Then you hear the other man, and he brings that information to light that maybe we shouldn't trust what Ziba says. Or maybe Mephibosheth has got something up his sleeve. Let's read this, verse 24. And Mephibosheth, the son of Saul, came down to meet the king. Of course, he's crippled. He had neither taken care of his feet, nor trimmed his beard, nor washed his clothes from the day the king departed until the day he came back in safety. And when he came to Jerusalem to meet the king said to him, why did you not go with me, Mephibosheth? The answer to that question could be his life or his death at this point. Remember the proverb? Life and death are in the hand of the king here. How are you going to answer this, Mephibosheth? He answered, my lord, O king, my servant deceived me, speaking of Ziba. For your servant said to me, I will saddle a donkey for myself that I may ride on it and go with the king, for your servant is lame. He has slandered your servant to my lord the king, but my lord the king is like the angel of God. Do therefore what seems good to you. For all my father's house were but men doomed to death before my lord the king, but you set your servant among those who eat at your table. What further right have I than to cry to the king? And the king said to him, why speak any more of your affairs? I've decided you and Ziba shall divide the land. And Mephibosheth said to the king, oh, let him take it all, since my lord the king has come safely home. So you could probably read into those words from Mephibosheth. Is he telling the truth here? Did he stay back in Jerusalem because he is trying to be opportunistic and be favored by Absalom? Or he was unable to saddle a donkey and Ziba didn't help him out? Is Ziba the culprit here? And it seems that way. And he comes back and says, okay, well, if you're going to divide the land, let him have it all. It's not important to me. So maybe we have the better character here in Mephibosheth over Ziba. But all that stuff happening, and David's coming into this, and someone's trying to get an opportunity in this, and David chooses instead, I'm just going to divide it right down the middle. I'm not going to deal with this. It's best to have it that way than try to work out more information and figure out who's telling the truth in this. And so he does so. Then further verses here, verse 41, jump down to 41. Then all the men of Israel came to the king and said to the king, why have our brothers, the men of Judah, stolen you away and brought the king and his household over the Jordan and all David's men with him? Well, it was David's request to do that. He got Judah to do this. It was right in his eyes to do this. But now all the tribes are jealous of that. I mean, this is a pretty crazy situation for David to be ruling these people in this way and their attitudes. Verse 42, all the men of Judah answered the men of Israel. So now Judah's barking. Because the king is our close relative, why then are you angry over this matter? Have we eaten it all at the king's expense? Or has he given us any gift? And the men of Israel answered the men of Judah, we have 10 shares in the king, and in David also we have more than you. Why then did you despise us? Were we not the first to speak of bringing back our king? But the words of the men of Judah were fiercer than the words of the men of Israel. So they're bickering in the street over who gets to bring David back to Jerusalem and who's more weight or credibility in the kingdom or the court or the table of David. So here we have the story. Here's David's challenge. He's bickering or seeing the bickering of his own nation. And then there's one more. Chapter 20, verse 1. Sheba. Now there happened to be there a worthless man. Didn't I read worthless man there in Proverbs? Watch out for the worthless ones, the deceptive ones, the plotters of evil. Here is one. Whose name was Sheba, the son of Bichri, a Benjamite. This is the house. This is the same tribe of Saul. And he blew the trumpet and said, we have no portion in David. We have no inheritance in the son of Jesse. Every man to his tent, O Israel. So all the men of Israel withdrew from David and followed Sheba, the son of Bichri. But the men of Judah followed their king steadfastly from the Jordan to Jerusalem. Now some years from this point, the nation, after Solomon and then his son Rehoboam, the nation would divide into two, and you would get this, the northern tribes, and you would get Judah. You would get the Jews. You'd get them and one other tribe. This nation just wants to divide. This nation doesn't want to get behind David for some reason. It appears what we have here with David, he's caught in the middle of this national division and jealousies and controversies, strife, personal agendas. Of course, you're right after a civil war. It's a very difficult situation. I can understand why Solomon, if you jump ahead with me to the book of 1 Kings chapter 3, why Solomon would pray a prayer to God at the beginning of his rule and request these specific things from God. In chapter 3 of 1 Kings, in verse 6 to 9, and he prays to God, he says this, verse 6, you have shown great and steadfast love to your servant David, my father, because he walked before you in faithfulness, in righteousness, and in uprightness of heart toward you. You've kept for him this great and steadfast love and have given him a son to sit on his throne this day. And now, O Lord my God, you've made your servant king in place of David my father. Although I am but a little child, I do not know how to go out or come in. And your servant is in the midst of your people whom you have chosen, a great people, too many to be numbered or counted for multitude. Give your servant, therefore, an understanding mind to govern your people, that I may discern between good and evil. For who is able to govern this great people? See the prayer? Those are wise words from young, wise Solomon, and a great prayer. Why would that be so important? Well, in light of what David had to go through, you can understand. That's a great prayer. I need help to figure this out, to manage and to rule this people. Even the wisest of men, as we see here, can't really get to the bottom of all the quarrels, personal quarrels. Even the wisest of kings can't keep control of every controversy, every conspiracy, every intrigue, every political opinion. He's got people who are under him that you'd think are loyal to you, and yet they have stuff going on. Can't satisfy everybody all the time. He can't make everybody happy all the time. So there are culprits here. And David is one who, as best we can throw out there, has a human, I think, in this situation, yet so dependent on God to give guidance and wisdom and to protect the nation. Let me take you now, backing up chapter 13. There are some good ones. There are some good ones that are around him. Call them the dignified ones. In the middle of all this going on, amongst the tribes, strife, arguing, jealous, you got the Shebas, you got Abishai, you got Ziba, you got Mephibosheth, you got all sorts of stuff kind of working its way around and trying to use David, trying to influence David or reject David or whatever it may be. And then there's some good guys. These are the loyal guys. Verse 31 of chapter 19. Now Barzillai, the Gileadite, had come down from Regolim. And he went on with the king to the Jordan to escort him over the Jordan. Barzillai was a very aged man, 80 years old. He had provided the king with food while he stayed at Mahanaim, for he was a very wealthy man. And the king said to Barzillai, "Come over with me, and I will provide for you with me in Jerusalem." But Barzillai said to the king, "How many years have I still to live that I should go up with the king to Jerusalem? I am this day 80 years old. Can I discern what is pleasant and what is not?" In other words, he's saying there, you know, I'm losing my taste. I'm losing my sense of smell. And you can give me all this elaborate stuff and I won't really enjoy it. So you're wasting it on me. Then he says, "Can your servant taste what he eats or what he drinks? Can I still listen to the voice of singing men and singing women? Why then should your servant be an added burden to my lord, the king? Don't waste your time on me. I'm too old. Everything's breaking down." Verse 36. "Your servant will be or will go a little way over the Jordan with the king. Why should the king pay me with such a reward? Please let your servant return that I may die in my own city near the grave of my father and my mother. But here's your servant, Chimham. Let him go over with my lord, the king, and do for him whatever seems good to you." The king answered, "Chimham shall go over with me, and I will do for him whatever seems good to you, and all that you desire of me I will do for you." And all the people went over the Jordan, and the king went over, and the king kissed Barzillai and blessed him, and he returned to his own home. The king went on to Gilgal, and Chimham went on with him. All the people of Judah and also half the people of Israel brought the king on his way. So here's this entourage of people, and it started back in Menahem. That was the place where he went to secure himself in fleeing from Absalom and turned around and the victory happened over on that side. This particular individual, Barzillai, we learn of him here as a wealthy individual. He provided for the king and his men at that time, food and hospitality. He was a loyal subject. And here he's just seeing him on his way and David wants to bless him. This is a gracious man, gracious Barzillai. Wealthy man, generous in his support when given the opportunity. He's not creating strife. He's not creating jealousies. He's not trying to work his way into the king's administration so he can have a little piece of power and use the king for his own benefit. No, he just wants to go home, live out the rest of his day, die, and be buried with the rest of his family. That's it. There's no pretentiousness with this individual. That's the type of subject that the king, I think, David, at this time, appreciates. This is the type of subject that God brings in to a person's life when they're struggling with so much that there's some people that just God blesses and encourages them and helps them to know that the Lord is still on his throne watching over all this. Chimham, he says, is a servant. He probably is either a son of Barzillai or a grandson. 1 Kings 2:7 indicate that David had given land in Bethlehem to Chimham, an individual named Chimham. And so here he's taken into the table, into the feasting, into the court of David where he would live there, and he would be blessed by that, and he gives him land to dwell in, which would be the regions and probably personal possessions of David in his hometown in Bethlehem. Just a respectable individual, one that he could trust and one that would be loyal to David as well, a son or grandson of Barzillai. This is an example. The apple probably doesn't fall very far from the tree. I'll take him in, absolutely. He will be the one that will represent you, Barzillai, and he will be lifted up. And then there's another individual that I would say is not a culprit. I'll call him unlucky Amasa. I told you about Amasa, the nephew. He's a cousin of Joab and Abishai, the sons of Zariah. Amasa shows up here in verse 4 of chapter 20. As David came to the house in verse 3 at Jerusalem, king took the 10 concubines who he had left to care for the house, put them in a house under guard, provided for them, did not go into them, so they were shut up until the day of their death, living as if in widowhood. Verse 4, then the king said to Amasa, call the men of Judah together to me within 3 days and be here yourself. So Amasa went to summon Judah, but he delayed beyond the set time that he had been appointed him. David said to Abishai, now Sheba, the son of Bichri, will do us more harm than Absalom. Take your Lord's servants, pursue him, lest he get himself to fortified cities and escape from us. And there went out after him Joab's men and the Cherethites and the Pelethites and all the mighty men. They went out from Jerusalem to pursue Sheba, the son of Bichri. When they were at the great stone that is in Gibeon, Amasa came to meet them. Now Joab was wearing a soldier's garment, and over it was a belt with a sword in its sheath fastened on his thigh, and as he went forward, it fell out. And Joab said to Amasa, is it well with you, my brother? And Joab took Amasa by the beard with his right hand to kiss him, but Amasa did not observe the sword that was in Joab's hand. So Joab struck him with it in the stomach and spilled his entrails to the ground without striking a second blow, and he died. We'll stop there. Unlucky Amasa, the cousin. His mother is Nahash, the sister of Zariah. He's a nephew, therefore, of David, of the house of Judah, in that family. He should be knit closer to Joab, thus my brother. There should be some respect, but kind of gives you the perspective there of Joab's character. He's given an assignment here. You got 3 days. Rally Judah together. We're going to go after Sheba. It's kind of asking a lot. He delayed in that. And therefore, David moved ahead, sent Abishai, and sent the soldiers on to do the job. But really what David had done was put Amasa in a precarious position. Remember, he said these words back in chapter 19, verse 13. Say to Amasa, are you not my bone and my flesh? God do so to me, more so also, if you are not commander of my army from now on in place of Joab. Joab heard that. Joab got news of that. Joab had a plan. The violent one would take his own cousin and he would take his own life. That's the type of person that Joab is. Amasa dies as a result of this. He's trying to do what is right and honor the king. Let's read on here in verse 10 and 11. Then Joab and Abishai, his brother, pursued Sheba, the son of Bichri. One of Joab's young men took his stand by Amasa and said, whoever favors Joab and whoever is for David, let him follow Joab. And Amasa lay wallowing in his blood in the highway, and anyone who came by seeing him stopped. And when the men saw and all the people stopped, he carried Amasa out of the highway into the field and threw a garment over him. When he was taken out of the highway, all the people went out or went on after Joab to pursue Sheba, the son of Bichri. And Sheba passed through all the tribes of Israel to Abel of Beth Maaka, and all the Bichrites assembled and followed him in. And all the men who were with Joab came and besieged him in Abel Beth Maaka. They cast up a mound against the city, and it stood against the rampart, and they were battering the wall to throw it down. Then a wise woman called from the city, "Listen, listen, tell Joab, come here that I may speak to you." And he came near her, and the woman said, "Are you Joab?" He answered, "I am." And she said to him, "Listen to the words of your servant." And he answered, "I'm listening." And she said, "They used to say in former times, 'Let him but ask counsel of Abel.' And so they settled a matter. I am one of those who are peaceable and faithful in Israel. You seek to destroy a city that is a mother of Israel. Why will you swallow up the heritage of the Lord?" Joab answered, "Far be it from me, far be it that I should swallow up or destroy. That's not true. But a man of the hill country of Ephraim called Sheba, the son of Bichri, has lifted up his hand against the king David. Give up him alone, and I will withdraw from the city." The woman said to Joab, "Behold, his head shall be thrown to you over the wall." Then the woman went to all the people in her wisdom, and they cut off the head of Sheba, the son of Bichri, and threw it out to Joab. So he blew the trumpet. They dispersed from the city, every man to his home. And Joab returned to Jerusalem to the king. Now Joab was in command of all the army of Israel. And Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, was in command of the Cherethites and the Pelethites. Those are the bodyguards of the king. And Adoram was in charge of the forced labor. Jehoshaphat, the son of Ahilud, was the recorder. And Sheva, the secretary, and Zadok and Abiathar were priests. And Ira, the Jerahite, was also David's priest. And so we have how it all comes back together at this point. And yet here's Joab. What is up with this guy? I wouldn't put him in the category of the dignified ones. I would put him in a special category of those culprits. I wouldn't necessarily put him even in that area, because he would be a person who's shown his loyalty to the king. He had been a warrior. He had been a courageous, brave warrior. Here he is doing the king's service. But there's something of a power lust in him, that the king would want Amasa to take over the armies. Joab is going to slay this guy. Joab's also the same guy who killed Abner, the other one, the other general. This one wanted no competition. He wanted power, and he wanted control. He wanted that notoriety under David. Is that a man you could trust? Here's a man who's questionable. Tendency towards violence to get what he wants. Again, like the Proverbs that the kings say, watch out for the violent ones. Watch out for those. So David clearly wanting him to be replaced, but that's not what he got. How David manages this, you'll see as we work our way through the next chapters, because Joab's going to be in the back of his mind here. I've got to keep an eye on this guy. And at the death of David, he would give a command to his son Solomon regarding Joab. And by the way, Shimei too. We'll see that later down the road. But he's got to manage this. He's got to deal with this. And in doing so, he's got to be wise and careful in wanting to establish righteousness. I can only imagine the complex, sophisticated, intrigue-filled world of the politics of David, let alone in Washington today. And what a president, what a congressman has to juggle or manage and keep under control just the people around him, let alone his enemies across the aisle. So all of this, I think we could at least think about as we are approaching election day. Pray for our leaders. Pray for our election. Pray for the outcome. Pray for the response of the citizens in this nation in receiving the outcome. Who knows what's going to happen here, but we definitely need to pray. Let me give you a few words and thoughts about these chapters that we want to take in application. First is this, Romans 12. Vengeance belongs to the Lord. It doesn't belong to Joab the general. It doesn't belong to Absalom, the son of David. It belongs to the Lord. Absalom wanted vengeance for his sister and more. Joab wanted to avenge the king. Abishai wanted to avenge the king. Shimei cursed him. I should take this guy out on account of what he's done to you. We need to keep these words in mind in Romans 12. Beloved, never avenge yourselves, but leave it to the wrath of God, for it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. To the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him something to drink. For by so doing, you will heap burning coals on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. That's great and sound advice. Also this, men's wrath does not produce the righteousness of God. Whatever Joab's agenda is, or Abishai's agenda, or Absalom's agenda, I can tell you this, it didn't produce righteousness. It didn't produce the righteousness of God. In James chapter 1, in verse 19, know this, my beloved brothers, let every person be quick to hear, slow to speak, slow to anger, for the anger of man does not produce the righteousness of God. Therefore, put away all filthiness, rampant wickedness, and receive with meekness the implanted word which is able to save your souls. It's a lesson we need to continually remind ourselves of. Man's wrath does nothing more than produce more sins. Thirdly, did you notice sin has a way of multiplying and mushrooming? It just produces long-term suffering, produces other sins, and you just see that happening here, and it just keeps spreading in the family of David. A lot of it coming back to David could say, it was because of my sin that the sword now will not depart from my family. Civil strife, power, revenge, all of that just keeps mushrooming. What can stop that sin? That is the grace of God. God's grace is greater. It's amazing to know, even though all of this is happening in David's family, some of it was David himself, some of it is his own sons, and yet David would still be the father, the figurehead of the Messiah, the family of Messiah. He would still be given the opportunity and the privilege of writing these psalms, many of them. He's still known as the man after God's own heart 1,000 years later. Even after all of that, that is the grace of God in the life of this man who humbled himself. His sons needed to learn that example of humbling themselves under the mighty hand of God. Grace is greater than our sin. And one more thing, if I could speak to those with Ziba and Mephibosheth, be careful not to become ungrateful. I mean, David was so generous to Mephibosheth and Ziba in that situation. They came right out of the house of Saul. And for a king to take over and establish his dynasty to replace the other, typically you just wipe them all out so you don't have to deal with this type of stuff. And yet the graciousness of David to establish them and give them this property and give them possessions, give them a place in his kingdom, response there should be gratitude, not ungratefulness. And I think especially in Ziba, he was an opportunist. He was greedy. He was not grateful. He wanted to take more than what was given him. And he had great privilege. We don't want that type of attitude. Let's be grateful to anything that God gives us, especially the forgiveness of sins that he grants to us. All right, let's pray. Lord, I do thank you for just to be able to walk through these historical records in the Bible, the people that you worked with, the people that you used to carry out your will and your purposes in history. Thankful for Scripture and the truth that it delivers to us and tells of us. It tells the whole truth, including all of the conspiracies, all of the evil, all of the the choices and decisions that men and women make, good ones and bad ones. And there's much bloodshed there. There's much struggle there and strife. I'm grateful to see the truth of what man is like. It's no different today. Even in our free society in America, in the land of the free, the land where we have opportunity, the land where we have uninhibited privileges compared to anywhere else in this world, and yet we struggle so much with the strife and the jealousies and the bitterness and the fighting and the lies, the deceptions. There's many who are violent. There's many who are worthless persons. There are many who are the whisperers. Just as the proverb says, in this, Lord, we as Christians are to live and to be light and to be the opposite, to be the example of the righteous. We want to establish righteousness. We want to establish truth. We want to see those things lifted high. We want to see the righteous protected and flourishing and productive. We want to see the wicked to be restrained and wickedness to be stopped. This is our prayer, Lord, for our nation. This is our prayer for our church, for our community. We would ask, Lord, that you would hear these words and answer and give what you see and deem is best as we desire to see this. Bless our time, Lord, from this evening forward into this week and the things that we have in store on the plate for us. And may you encourage our hearts. May you help us to be diligent, keep us healthy, keep our church healthy. And may we see our church back together in full 100% capacity soon as you work these things out. Thank you as we pray in Christ's name. Amen.